LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Mark Olley, who joins us to discuss his book, Revealing the Green Man. To many, the Green Man is little more than a chubby face peering through a veil of leaves. Sometimes cute, sometimes vaguely sinister, he is nonetheless widely regarded as merely a meaningless symbol from an age long lost. In reality, however, he could rather be said to be the esoteric embodiment of the very essence of life itself, an ancient archetype once known the world over. On a journey through myths and legends, magic and folklore, we explore the mystery of the Green Man. From the time of the Celts and Druids, the rise of the Roman Empire, the Anglo-Saxon annals, and the descent into the Dark Ages and beyond, we meet with Robin Hood, Herne the Hunter, King Arthur, and many other colourful characters along the way. It is a tale pregnant with arcane symbolism, cultish rites, the perennial wisdom of as above, so below, and the final revelation of the Earth's eternal cycle of destruction and rebirth. Thousands of years ago, man went to war with nature, and thus to war with himself. Lost to the land as once was, he became master of the world, for a while. Blinded by arrogance, hobbled by hubris, and emboldened by his technological toys, he brought the biosphere to the brink of oblivion, to exalt himself at the Earth's expense. This is our story, and we are not as clever as we might like to believe. In a timely relearning of the Green Man's lessons, in the twilight of the Industrial Age, we are being invited, perchance for the final time, to change our ways or perish. Hello and welcome, Mark, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you.
Today, Mark, we're going to be talking about your new book, which is called Revealing the Green Man. Before we jump into that, just tell listeners a little bit about yourself and about your work in general.
Well, people will probably know me best from an ITV Granada Sky series called Lost Treasures, which we did about, we started filming it 10 years ago. And the last time it was aired was in 2011, and that was on the Sky History Channel. We've done a few specials for Sky. I've been an archaeologist since I was a very, very young boy, as I started digging as a volunteer. Some people might remember me from the music industry, which I spent about 21 years in as a drummer for my sins. And then, sort of in recent times, I've taken up writing books, which is where Revealing the Green Man came from, which I think I'm right in saying is book number 5 or 6 since the 1990s. I've done 3 sort of regional history books and 3 books, it's number 6 actually, I've done 3 books for John Hunt Publishing, which are the chaps that have done the Green Man one. So that's a bit about me, really. I'm interested in all sorts of things, as you'll gather.
Now, I said something in my introduction about the legend of the Green Man, but just from your perspective, if someone, you're chatting to someone, they're like, the Green Man, what's that? I mean, in a couple of minutes, how would you generally explain where it comes from? Because, you know, we're going to be getting into it in detail, but just so that for people on the top of the show here who are new to it.
From my point of view, most people ask me the question because they've encountered the medieval image, which is the popular image that you find in garden centres and people hang it on the walls, and it's kind of a chubby, cheery face or a slightly grim-looking face surrounded by leaves. And that's the image that most people are familiar with. So that's the question I'm usually asked, is with respect to that sort of green man. But that is actually quite a late symbol in the history of the green man. The green man has been around probably since prehistoric times. There's certainly evidence by the late Stone Age, going into the early Metal Ages, that by that point they'd got some concept that fed into the origins of the green man. So really, the green man is, I suppose, the essence of life itself, life on Earth. And that's really how I'd explain it. I would say it's all the different historical viewpoints down the ages on that life force that inhabits everything.
Now, from my personal point of view, I first encountered it in exactly the way that you describe, as that type of figure. I think it probably was on a door knocker somewhere, a brass door knocker. This, you mentioned that this like ancient idea, and this concept, this symbol, this archetype, whatever, has ancient roots. And I was surprised to learn, I mean, I learned something about this later, but when I was reading your book, just how far back we're talking, it seems to be about as far back as we can go. We find the same sort of archetype, symbols, concepts, whatever kind of terminology you want to use. And I suppose we would expect that, you know, given that really, if we, you know, go back, the idea of life on Earth as one system of which we are part and not separate, you'd expect it to be unified in that way. So,
yeah, I mean, I was, when I started gathering my notes together, I've done the Green Man as a PowerPoint presentation for quite a number of years. And when I started to gather all the notes together, I realised that actually I'd got an awful lot more ancient material than I thought I had. And when you start to look at things like the Babylonian epics, which, of course, are on clay tablets and they're written in cuneiform, it's about the oldest thing you can get your hands on that has a sort of coherent, educated, readable, translatable linguistic background. Everything else is pictures, images, guesswork. You really start with these old Babylonian tablets, and it's there. You know, the concept of the Green Man is right there at the very beginning. And the key to that, which is the key to the beginning of the book, it's the turning point where mankind suddenly decides that it's going to take Mother Nature on, or Father Nature, depending on what you believe. It's where man suddenly thinks, right, okay, I'm not going to just wander around picking berries or apples or, you know, whatever's available, hunting the game as it wanders through. I'm not being a hunter-gatherer anymore. I'm actually going to become this thing, this newfangled idea of something called a farmer. And basically, when we change to this agricultural culture, which happens in the days of these tablets, you get man literally taking the world on, and it becomes a struggle, and he starts to clear areas and manipulate the planet and change the environment that he's living in to his advantage. So obviously it means we can expand as a race. There can be more people, less death, less disease, less famine, etc., etc. But then you've got this thing where all of a sudden, in the epic I quote, which is the Epic of Gilgamesh, this guy suddenly thinks, right, I'm going to take the forest on. I'm not content with just chopping down grass and picking up weeds, etc. This is it, I'm going into the woods. And that's really where it all begins. That's when the sheer power and excitement and mystery, and it's almost like being super, super naughty and going where man has never gone before, you know, and going off and doing something that is just a little bit radical and a bit out of the frame. And that's really where we come in at the beginning of the book with this Epic of Gilgamesh thing. They've got this concept of a god called Humbaba that lives out in the woods. And I think what I try to get over in the book is that we don't actually fully appreciate what that concept is. If somebody took you, I suppose, into some of the less explored parts of America or up in the Canadian Rockies or whatever, and just dumped you in the middle of a forest where literally nobody had ever set foot, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about an ecosystem which man is not part of and never has been part of, and it suddenly takes on, well, it's like a moon landing, you know what I mean? You've gone to another planet, you're in another world, and it doesn't obey the rules and regulations that mankind are normally accustomed to. I mean, the voice does strange things in forests. The environment is a strange environment. You can't see things more than a certain distance. The ecology does things in some forests. I mean, I went to visit South America a couple of years ago, and pretty much everything wants to eat you. You know, it's not a wonderful place to be initially when it's not been tamed, in inverted commas. And that's what I was trying to get over in that first chapter. So that's the sort of thing that ancient mankind would have come face to face with, taking on something which you get the impression from the Epic of Gilgamesh, they've bitten off more than they can chew. You know, this is a huge step out of the frame for them to go and hack a woods down and start using the resources that are out there. And that carries on right through. You know, it's a thread that runs all the way through history.
Well, even if you subscribe to the idea, the belief, whatever, that man was ultimately somehow descended from trees, you know, in terms of evolution, it's clear that at some point, you know, probably long before, you know, agriculture, to go back to hunter-gatherer phase, what have you, that the forest was abandoned as a natural habitat, if it ever was. And we have this idea also, of course, at some point in history, you mentioned, you know, the clearing of forests, agriculture, allowed for human expansion, much greater population numbers. There would have been, depending on the topography and the climate and everything, but there have been great swathes of the earth at various times. Probably most of the history actually that would have been absolutely enmeshed in vegetation that would have made it, you know, virtually uninhabitable for humans.
Well, again, the British Isles, certainly within recorded history, if you go back to, shall we say, the times of the Greeks and the Romans, so you're looking sort of, I mean, foundation of Rome's around 750 BC. So if you start looking at that sort of time period, there's this idea, this concept that you could release a squirrel on the south coast and it could hop from tree to tree all the way up to the north coast of Scotland. We really here in Britain only lost our woodland due to deforestation to do with things like Spanish Armada when they built all the ships, Tudor period when all the houses were being made from timber. The sort of woodland management of the medieval period came to an end and they just started to clear them. So we don't have in this country the woods that we had, well, even 2,000 years ago, we were covered, absolutely covered in trees, and they've all disappeared. It's when people go up on places like the Moorlands and they see these wonderful views and they think, wow, this is absolutely amazing, you know, national parks and all that. This moorland is tremendous, you know, but what they don't realise is they're actually looking at an ecological disaster, because that all used to be woods. The reason there's sort of 15, 20 foot of peat is because there's been trees dropping leaves on these moorlands for the best part of, well, goodness knows how many thousand years. And it's only since the introduction of sheep in the 1700s that all the little tiny shoots and all the greenery that was necessary to support the ecology has vanished. So you've ended up with these wildernesses, great swathes of moorland and what have you, that once upon a time would have been just trees as far as the eye could see. So we've lost that. And the book tends to try and put a bit of that back, if you like. I've got to say the book's slightly British orientated. There are a lot of examples from around the world, which sort of fits in the bits of the jigsaw puzzle that we're missing. But it is essentially a British book. It's about the experience that we've had here in this country. But then again, why not? You know, that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, that's my experience too.
Yeah.
I mean, I grew up in Ireland, but it might as well have been the same experience. It's the same basic, types of forest and the same way that they were cleared and everything else. So I know certainly I've not been to explore what little is left of Nottingham Forest, but that's one that looms large in, you know, in stories around the world. And when I've driven past, you know, is it the A1, I think, goes past there,
yeah.
And you can go into Nottingham Forest Visitor Centre, and I think at some point it's like so thin that you can virtually see through it. You know, it must be such a disappointment for Robin Hood fans.
Well, yeah, I can get a plug in, because obviously the book I did before I did The Green Man was The Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood. That was the one that I produced for John Hunt immediately before The Green Man. And we went down to Nottingham, we did all sorts of research around Sherwood and places like that. It really struck me that the great oak, which is this massive tree, 1,000-year-old tree, and everything's held up on, you know, pieces of wood, and all the branches and that are sort of sagging. And they have this wonderful story where, you know, Robin's trying to escape, so he hides up this wonderful tree. The only snag is it would have been a 3 or 4 inch shoot coming out of an acorn when he was alive. So if he hid up it, he would have flattened it. So the excuse that they give now is that it's actually an offshoot. It's an acorn from the tree that he hid up. But as you say, in reality, the great forests which were there are gone. The medieval forests are gone. between sort of the 1100s when Robin was alive to where we are now in the 2000s. All those forests have just been used, they've been used up in the various projects that different monarchs have undertaken and the way people have lived. So yeah, we just don't have the forests like we used to have.
I remember back in the 1980s reading Brian Bates' book. I've never actually known how to pronounce this correctly. Maybe you can throw some light on it, but The Way of Weird. And
Weird.
Yeah.
W-Y-R-D.
That's
weird.
Good.
Weird.
Well, that, weird. Okay.
Weird.
In there, he describes a boat journey, and I've not read it for many years, but I remember thinking, okay, these guys getting into this little boat, off the coast they go, and then they travel along, and then they arrive at their destination. It's amazing to find out that what they've basically done is they've left one point of the coast of Britain, and they've traveled up the coast of Britain and landed at another point in the coast of Britain, and they've done this because it's easier, safer, all sorts of beneficial reasons for
traveling. Oh, gosh, yes.
Because the forest was impenetrable.
Yeah, it was just in the road. It was in the way. You only had two choices. You either followed the Roman road system, and the Romans actually passed a law where they said you had to clear so many, well, as we would say, so many metres, it was about 20 yards either side had to be cleared, in order to stop robbery and people appearing out of the woods suddenly and you know, grabbing people on the road. So you had all these major highways. And then the other choice was sail. That's the only choice you had. Of course, by the time it gets to Saxon invasion times, which, I mean, Weird is a Saxon magical thing, by the time you get to the Saxons, the roads are going out of use and the woods are gradually encroaching back. So, of course, just before the Vikings, when you're at the end of the Saxon period, you're looking sort of 700 AD, most of the Roman roads are out of use and they've disappeared because the woods have encroached back. You've had sort of 300 years of regrowth, as it were. So, yeah, fully understand that. The ancient world seems to revolve mostly around sailing and seaways. If you've got a river or you've got a sea that you can cross, it's all about that. It's about navigation and sailing.
Now, just briefly, because it caught my interest with relation to British history, can we just say something about this copper stroke solar cult idea that you document in the book? Just because that was something that brought together some ideas that I was familiar with from disparate sources. Your book is interesting because it's not a big book. And it's you've taken an interesting approach because I was reading about this, I say, the copper solar cult thing. It's drawing together these different strands, but you don't have this huge exposition where you go into a lot of detail. I think you're trying to sort of evoke things, but I was just very interested in this particular aspect of the book.
Primarily, it was the publisher. I've got to say that. He basically contacted me and just said, do you reckon you could do this in 25,000 words? And I think it's 24,940-something words when I gave it in, because I'm pretty good at doing things like that. But I would perhaps have gone into more detail. But I think he was absolutely right in making it a tight, sort of punchy book. His idea was simply to raise questions and then have people sort of scurry off and find out more information. The idea that there was some kind of a cult circling around the concept of copper and greenery and the fact that it's coming out of the ground, and you'll find it now manifesting itself in some of the documentaries they do. If you watch History Channel or Time Team or whatever, some of the old episodes, they talk about these guys making metal as being magicians and being alchemists, because they could take this metal, which just looked like green, you know, stuff growing out of the rock, and they could turn it into this fantastic liquid magical golden stuff. And then as time progressed, they had this ability then to throw other things in, zinc and tin and bits of other things. They'd obviously messed about and came up with this formula that effectively produces bronze. And that revolutionized the use of copper because they could do this. But I particularly remember a Time Team episode when they were doing this. They had bellows going and they had a blower sort of melting this copper inside a crucible, and they took the lid off, and there's the blazing sun of the crucible opening, as it were, this hot, round, red circle that looked exactly like the setting sun. And then this guy who was doing it just grabbed this pile of powder and just threw it in, and it kind of went woof. And the guy who was interviewing him just said, what was that? And he said, oh, alchemy, can't really tell you, sort of thing, and left it at that. But that's what these guys were like. But it actually goes back to something that archaeologists began to notice quite a long time ago, 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. writers like Jaquetta Hawkes and people like that were producing books where they'd linked up various symbols that were in use in rock art and things like that. They'd realised represented something to do with the sun. And then you had other writers at the same time doing a similar sort of thing, looking at metals and how the metals were being mined. And they sort of started to make links. It got quite exciting in the 1970s. They were saying, well, you know, the guy that's in this cremation urn has got a, you know, a circle drawn into the bottom of it with an equal arm cross. He's got chamfers all around the sides of the urn. The chamfers represent the sea. It means he was a sailor. The circle on the bottom is solar, so it's a cross. There's a piece of some kind of bronze implement or whatever buried inside the pot. So obviously he was a metal worker, he was a trader who sailed. Brilliant, they've joined the dots. And then all this information came flooding out, and then it just died. It died in the 1970s, because all of a sudden everybody seemed to go suddenly scientific. It was all about analysis and, you know, forensics, and in the 1980s, 1990s, it just went completely technological. And it was almost as if this idea of somehow joining the dots had been lost. But the key to it all is to reverse engineer it, is to say, hang on a minute, they didn't have computers, but they didn't even have numbers. They didn't have writing. They didn't have written language in the same way that we have it. They perhaps might have had phonetic spelling in their own alphabets, but they certainly weren't up to the standard we're up to now with things like the internet and that. So what they did was they communicated in pictures. And that is the key. The key is to sort of take your brain out, wring out all this modern-day stuff that we're full of, and then go back and say, OK, if it looks a particular way, then you can link it. So if you're digging green stuff out of the green floor of a green forest, and you know that greenery goes green when the sun rises, it's all to do with the seasons and the power of the sun, there's nothing wrong with assuming that somehow that green earth, the green in the planet itself, has somehow got something to do with that same process, that same kind of life thing. So somewhere down the line, I think they sort of thought, well, maybe this strange green stuff somehow is a gift from the gods. It comes down from the sun somehow. We don't know how. And as soon as they apply heat, they apply the power of fire, which is what the sun is. The sun is a sort of heat source, a fire source. It glows in the crucible exactly like the setting sun. So it becomes almost a poem. It becomes almost a religious experience to see this transformation of a lump of green rock turning into this golden magical implement. And that then, you can actually follow that through. It does follow quite logically. If you read John Matthews, etc., about King Arthur, and you read some of the things he's written about swords, the representation of this golden, bronze, shining Excalibur sword, that is, if you like, the other end of the same path. It's now gone so far down that road that the things made from copper themselves have now become sacred. And there's a sort of a whole 30 years of archaeological evidence that kind of speculates and, you know, swims in and out of the currents of that as an idea, as a concept and a theory, and then it just comes to an end. So I thought, well, actually, it's probably time to bring it back and resurrect it a little bit and say, no, science isn't always the answer. Sometimes you have to put your head into the head, your mind into the head of the person that was actually doing it at the time. So really, that's the solar copper cult. It's this idea that nothing on planet Earth happens, nothing here exists without the action of the sun. And I think all the ancient races of peoples without fail had grasped that. I think that is the most ultra basic concept of all, and it's just a further extension of that really basic concept, the idea that life on Earth is reliant on the sun. Then you can go off at another angle. There's all sorts of other tangents which I do in the book, because also copper can turn red when it's been refined. It can go red like blood, and it has a similar smell and a similar taste to blood. And then you've got this concept where the blood thing comes in and the human sacrifice thing comes in, and the idea that, you know, somebody can be sacrificed for the blood of the land, if you like, and put their life into the ground. And that becomes then this concept of the Celtic overworld and the Celtic afterlife, which again has been pretty well covered by other writers over the years. And that's really how it all ties up. That's where it all comes from.
Well, even now you take a copper coin and suck the edge of it and say, what does that taste like? It tastes like blood.
Yes, it does. Hmm. Absolutely, it does. But then I thought, well, project it forward. I mean, you've just done that. You've just projected it forward. You've taken a modern-day example. And the best example I can think actually happened completely by accident. I can't remember what context it was in. I think somebody mentioned something about lead musket balls, and we were talking about bullets. And I suddenly thought, hang on a minute, we are still using copper to kill people. And then it was like, ping, this light bulb just suddenly came on. And I thought, hang on a minute, soldiers carrying copper dressed in green. It's the same. Nothing's changed. It's exactly the same thread. The difference is, of course, the copper this time is a bullet jacket. It's, you know, I know they've gone off it now, and they've gone off and developed other sorts of bullets and what have you, but certainly for the best part of 150 years, they've been developing these copper-jacketed bullets. And again, for 150 years, somebody, some bright spark in the Napoleonic War, came up with this idea that if you dress in green, you can't be seen. Oh, let's use that as camouflage, that way less of us get killed. So it's gone back to that, which, in the book, as I point out, if these Celtic warriors were painting themselves in the metal of the sun, which is this copper, as soon as they paint themselves all over with this refined copper powder, they would in turn go green. They would actually go green. And that's why Julius Caesar, when he landed with his troops, couldn't find anybody to fight. Because they're all sat there in the greenery, camouflaged, waiting for these shiny Romans, these nice, you know, beautiful reds and blues and shiny metal armour and all the rest of it, just waiting for them to leave the beach. And as soon as they leave the beach, that's it, dead, gone. They don't even know what's hit them. And it's just that has just carried on, and it's become part of the 21st century. The links, the sort of the whole pattern of how it all ties up is just fantastic. It really is. That's what I tried to get over in the book as well. You start with really ultra basic things at the beginning of the book. By the time you reach the end of the book, you're very much into the 21st century. I didn't want the book to just stop. I wanted it to push the boundaries forward a little bit and say, you know, hey, we need to recognise the existence of this life force. All paths, all religions, all human beings have got to acknowledge that this thing is there, because if we don't, we've had it. You know, we're going to die out as a race and it'll all be over. So I kind of, you know, I push that a bit towards the end.
I remember, it's funny you should just mentioning about modern soldiers, or, you know, relatively modern. I remember when we were teenagers, me and my friends, we liked to go, maybe as boys do, like to go into the woods, bit of an adventure, you know, maybe climb trees, you know, hack off a branch and make a stick to, you know, just a bit of an adventure. I didn't know, we were trying to get in touch with something, obviously, that we weren't getting in school. And there was one particularly well-preserved piece of woodland in an area, again, where a lot of the woodland had been decimated centuries before. Mm-hmm. But this particular piece of woodland, ironically, was off limits to the public. It was part of the military firing range, but there were holes. It was so big, there were holes in the fences, and we could go through there and into the woodland there, and we would find discharged bullets, and you would find the copper casings, you know, where the bullet tip had gone, and sometimes we would find the brass clip that the copper bullet would go into, and we would put these all together to make belts out of them.
They still do nowadays.
So I mean, that was just reminded me of exactly what you were saying, you know, and it just all of that in one space right there, and you know, not even 20 years ago, the same sort of symbolism. And that of course is important, you know, because what you referred to a few minutes ago is, you know, our scientific literal way of thinking, and we think in terms of language, and symbols are quite often lost on us.
Yeah, definitely. Pictorial thinking. I go even further, because I do a lot of work in schools, and there's a lot of kids in schools that are struggling. You know, they struggle with maths, they struggle with English. They've come up with all sorts of different, you know, letters and names for these different disorders and this, that and the other. And I look at these people and I just think, hang on a minute, just 100 years ago, those kids would have been geniuses. Just because they don't work in numbers and letters doesn't mean that they can't work in pictures. And some of the greatest men, the greatest minds, the greatest inventors who think outside the box, most of the majority of them, are these pictorial thinkers that don't obey the rules. They don't just go down the rules of looking at what are essentially simple patterns. If you think in pictures and you think outside the box, you tend to go a bit wacky and you become original. And you start to mix and match things that you know, most people nowadays perhaps wouldn't think of mixing and matching. And that in itself becomes an act of creativity. What was it somebody said many, many years ago? I did my time at art college, and this idea that somebody came out with a saying where they said, all art is significant deformity. And that stayed with me, because we never create something out of nothing. We always take what we already have and create something with it. And once we've done that, we then call that new. And that is the process. And I think people that just think solely in letters and solely in numbers, and dare I even stick my neck out and say solely in computers, so they sat in front of a computer, or they sat in front of a television set, or they sat in front of a mobile phone or a tab or whatever, they're dealing with technology which actually limits the human ability to draw in all the necessary information from the environment around them. That isn't in the book. I don't think that really comes out in the book, because the book always talks about just the life force and the green man and the energy that comes from that one source. Whereas what I'm saying is, I think as human beings we should cut loose and look at all things in a completely different way, not just that one aspect. And it's by looking at all things, becoming generalists and drawing influence from everywhere, that these new things, these new ideas and concepts, etc., come about. And it's funny, actually, because language and mathematics and even computing, if you go to higher mathematics and you really push language to its limits and you look at some of the higher forms that are regarded as the best of the best with honours, all of a sudden those systems start to fall apart. The mathematics doesn't work anymore and the formulas don't stay stable, and this kind of instability begins to creep in again at a higher form. And that's nature's way of saying, hang on a minute, you can't just, you know, be so insecure that you cling on to this and pretend it's a constant and it's not set in stone, and that life is definitely not set in stone. So I'm not so sure it's, you know, as I say, the whole idea of thinking in pictures and drawing information in from elsewhere and other sources and mix and match, and that's the way we should be. I can give you another good example, another very good example of this. The idea of cloning and the idea that we can, you know, produce a uniform crop, you know, GM, genetically modified, and it's fabulous because it's all the same. That's completely wrong. That is utterly, utterly, utterly wrong. Because the one thing that the entire planet screams out is that nothing is the same. Everything is utterly different. It is totally inconsistent. So as soon as you produce something that is perfect and identical and it's fabulous and that's how it should be, that is categorically going to fail. That is not how it should be. Because the rest of the planet, the rest of life on Earth, will attack it and destroy it because it's not how it is. There is infinite diversity, and it's kind of a fact, and everyone just seems to have overlooked it. You know, oh, fantastic, we can clone sheep, look, we've got $25 and they've all got the same DNA. They've had it, they're doomed, they are not going to survive, that is not the way forward, because it's just not how things are, it's not how nature is. Anyway, I've had my little rant about that, so there you go.
No,
it kind of fits into life on Earth, I'm not quite sure where, but there you go.
No, I very much agree with you. I mean,
yeah.
It's this idea of trying to get everything standardized is following a sort of a machine directive, you know, of the industrial age. You saw some tendencies in this direction with the development of agriculture, and then maybe sometimes in great civilizations in the past, Greeks and Romans, you might have seen some of these tendencies to try and organize things overly, but they, of course, all atrophied and collapsed in the end.
Absolutely.
And we now have this tremendous capacity to attempt to do these things, particularly with technology, particularly with computerized technology. But we see some very unpleasant outcomes already when we're tinkering with nature. And of course, it is the stuff of science fiction nightmares. Maybe of the last 100 years, all these books now made into films where man tries to set himself up above, I mean, Frankenstein's a good example, tries to set himself up above nature and ends up in catastrophe and nature fights back. I mean, The Long Weekend springs to mind for some reason, though I haven't watched that film for ages. You know, nature bites back. And of course, what we have, part of the problem here is that we have set ourselves as a species against nature, apart from nature. We imagine that nature is something to either there to, it's a problem to be dealt with, it's something to be conquered, or it's something to be exploited, or it's a trash can for us to throw our plastic when we're done with it. But the idea that we're somehow intrinsically part of it is seen as a bit quaint, and it's that tree hugging stuff, and it's the Gaia, and it's, you know, but of course that paradigm in itself is now changing, and whether we wake up to it or whether it's done by force, you know, we're going to be come round to this concept again that we cannot exist separate from the world that we live in and on.
No, I mean it's the book itself does that. The book on the Green Man goes full circle, and as you say, we've almost gone back to where we started, because all the civilizations that have tinkered and played and tried to alter and manipulate and change, they've all become victims in the end, because it has this life cycle. It's a shame, because as human beings, we discovered it. You know, we can test it, we can look at it, we can predict it. We know that all things, no matter what they are, have this, you know, birth, life, death, and it runs on a cycle. We can even, in some cases, predict how long societies will run, how long products will run, how long fads and ideas and concepts will run before they die and they get superseded. It's all actually predictable, and it really exists, but the average man in the street doesn't always grasp that this process is going on. And it's there in the book as well. It's there in my Green Man book. It does point out, I think one of the best quotes in the entire book is right at the very end. I got it when I was driving along in the car, that once upon a time we used to sacrifice ourselves for the earth, and now we sacrifice the earth for ourselves. Impossible. Absolutely impossible. We can't live like that. You know, we can't do it. We can't sacrifice the earth. We will come and go, but the planet will remain. And we need to get that into our heads, that that is what's going on. I think there's a Native American Indian quote where a very wise Indian says, you know, the planet is not what we use for ourselves. The planet is what we leave for our children. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that. I really do.
Okay, now you mentioned earlier the Robin Hood, obviously subject of your previous book. What I want to do is just walk through two or three mythological or symbolical stories or characters, and you can just perhaps say a little bit about how they interact with this, the symbology that you're talking about. Now, you mentioned Robin Hood already, and when I read that, I immediately started to think of the legend of Herne the Hunter. And of course, a few pages later in your book, there was Herne. So, yeah. And I remember watching, I mean, everyone will know about the story of Robin Hood, but for my generation, the archetypal telling was the 1980s TV series. And that was very popular at the time, and I watched it absolutely rapt, just because there was something, I didn't really understand it at the time, but looking back, there was something going on there beyond a kind of heroes and villains and damsels in distress and all the rest of it. There was something else going on. And looking back, it was something archetypal. There were symbolic things that were speaking to something in me, and I just was too young to grasp it. But there's a reason why these stories survive and sometimes get retold and adapted again and again in different forms. It's why they sometimes crop up in different parts of the world and they're the same thing. But, you know, obviously, yeah. Robin Hood and Herne and the associated things are very much part of, the story of these islands.
It's back to the foresters, because one of the biggest revelations for me, I'll come round to commenting on it, but I'm going to start at this particular point. I only fairly recently learnt that the Normans, when the Normans conquered Britain and they set up the Royal Hunting Forests, called their foresters verderers or verdigers, which literally in Norman French means green men. That's what they were. And the idea that they wear this skin of green, I thought, I've really got to get into this. And I started digging to look into it further. And it turns out that the cloth that they wear in medieval times is dyed using acetic acid, which is basically wee-wee, and copper powder. So they are literally, quite literally, in the ancient sense of the word, green men. They are wearing a coating of copper. Presumably when they got home at night after a sweaty day of chopping up wood in the trees and took the clothes off to get a wash, they would be stained green from the clothing. So they were quite literally green men. forward a little bit in time to Robin, because you're not in the 1000s, you're in the 1100s now. Robin's alive from, I think it's about around about 1130, I think I said in the book, winter of 1129 he was born, and he's alive through to about 1216. So he's 150 years later. The forest laws are already in place. The foresters are already in place. And Robin, as a sort of junior knight stroke forester, because he was a forester knight, would have worn the skin of green. So actually, the background to Robin Hood, the literal spiritual background to what he was following, was this long tradition of being a green man and following the tradition of a green man. That kind of ties up where we came in at the beginning, because I mentioned to you the idea of these little round faces that people can buy in garden centres and stick on the wall as symbols of you know, fertility or whatever. Those symbols, those green men, a majority of them, ended up in churches. So you've got lots of churches and chapels with this overtly pagan symbol slapped inside them. And the reason for that is the foresters' guilds, i.e. Robin Hood and his men, because they were foresters, and other foresters like them, they had the right to put the forest guild emblem in their local place of worship. So in the same way as you find, you know, boots for bootmakers and, you know, working, metalworking, horseshoes and things like that, all symbols of other professions, cloth workers and what have you, you find all their symbols, their guild symbols inside churches and chapels. You also find the green man. And that's why it's to do with these forest chapels. You also get pubs as well, old pubs called the Green Man, and you usually find that they're all sort of clustered on the perimeter of royal hunting forests. So it goes back to the Robin Hood thing. The Herne Hunter one's interesting because it's almost running parallel with the Green Man. The very early prehistoric shamans, the earliest depiction we've got, is this guy wearing a set of horns, and he's from the Magdalenian period, which off the top of my head I think is about 18,000 to 30,000 BC. It's very early, post Ice Age. It's in a cave in France. But the funny irony is we've got the actual headdresses, the actual horns with the holes drilled in to be mounted on somebody's head. We've got them at Starcar in Yorkshire, which is the exact same territory that Robin Hood was running over. So you start to wonder how on earth did all these threads somehow come together? Because these Ice Age hunter-gatherer horns, the horned headpieces, I think there's two of them or three of them, from Starcar, they were only found in the late Victorian, sort of early 20th century periods. So I'm thinking, well, hang on a minute, this is all these separates. I don't instantly have answers for all these links. I just know that, obviously, the Royal Hunting Forest, that's where the stags were, that's where all the deer were. Presumably the hunters and the people who could hunt in the forests and the foresters and the green men and people like Robin Hood, they had the right to hunt the stag. And the concept of this shamanic worship of the stag, the idea of somebody wearing a set of horns while going all the way back to post-Ice Age, somehow that concept survived as well as the green man concept. The idea was simply passed down from generation to generation to generation and so on. There was a time when archaeologists and historians just went, pah, not possible, can't be done. There's no way stuff like that can be transmitted over that period of time. Nowadays, it can be shown that names in the landscape and memories and stories and things that have been passed down very often do contain real information, genuine information, of things that has been passed down for thousands of years, not just hundreds. So it is possible, generation to generation, that when you were watching Robin Hood and you were watching, you know, Herne the Hunter appear in the woods, you've got Herne, who is the shamanic stag, the lord of the forest, but you've also got to consider that Robin is a representative of the solar deity. He is the green man, you know. So that's kind of, yes, it doesn't half plumb into something primeval. There's something in us that refuses to go away that still connects to those energies and those images, which are post-Ice Age, you know, post-glacial. Tremendous, absolutely tremendous piece of our history, now, our ancestry.
I mentioned earlier about being young boys, you know, moving into manhood and going into the forest and just for no apparent reason, not really understanding what was so appealing about it. Now, there's the other aspect of this, which, you know, there was always something, how can I put it, like, be careful in here there was always something about the experience that was kind of, be respectful in here, be careful in here, because yes, it's like the forest is your friend, but it could be your foe depending on your intention. And one thing that lives on for a lot of people in fairy tales and in nightmares sometimes is the idea of the forest after dark. You know, there's a something that maybe in our past, you know, again, we would have been wary of, but we would have perhaps had a better understanding of, a relationship with, that for a lot of people now is just associated with, you know, being attacked, being murdered, disappearing, Blair Witch Project or whatever. But two of the things I read about growing up, well, actually, one of them was reading, one was watching. And I do like to, as regular listeners of these shows will know, I do like to draw in popular culture things because a lot of people get ideas and from there. And the first of the two was John Berman's film of Excalibur. And at one point, whenever Arthur, his destiny is being revealed to him by Merlin, and Merlin takes him into the woods at night, and Arthur's terrified. Everywhere around him, there's a threat, there's a sound, and he doesn't understand it. And Merlin's like, what are you afraid of? You know, he's trying to show him something. And he's, you know, he says, do you know what's out there? And Arthur's like, no, what is it? And he goes, it's the dragon. And then, you know, and
I remember that.
This idea of a, like, it's almost like the Force in Star Wars. It's this all-encompassing thing. And for me, that's symbolic of some of what you're talking about, the life force. And the other one was when the first Shakespeare I ever read was Macbeth. And it's only a little part of the story, but it stuck with me in terms of spending time in the woods. And as at some point in the story, the prophecy, one of the witches is like, Macbeth shall never vanquished be until great Birnam Wood to high Dunsan and Hill shall come against him. The idea being that Macbeth will be invincible until the forest outside his castle comes to the castle. Now, of course, as far as Macbeth is concerned, well, this is insane. The forest's not going to move, and of course it does.
Yes,
and,
it does.
Spoiler alert, I'm not going to explain how that happens. But
I know how it happens, don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. But for anyone who hasn't read it, you know, or watched the... or watched Roman Polanski's wonderful film of Macbeth.
Fantastic.
It was this idea of a primeval power, and although in Macbeth it's symbolic, it's still, that stuck with me as kind of like this thing about forests. It's just one of these archetypal things that's buried in our, deeper than our psyche, the collective unconscious, if you like. And again, there's a reason for that, and then no matter how separate from this we become, I think that's why people who've maybe lived on the 20th floor of a 20-story concrete tower block and they've never been to a forest in their lives can still be touched by some of these images, some of these symbols that I'm talking about.
Well, the book itself, I say in one part, you know, anybody reading this book should really just go out into the woods, basically, and sit in the woods and read it, because obviously that's what it's all about. But the reasoning behind that, I mean, I'm totally with Merlin on this. I fully understand why he took Arthur out there. Because it's like a light bulb that has to be turned on. And there are so many people on so many different spiritual paths who are quite content to sit in their own house. And their own house, although it's not completely dead, is essentially a dead environment in comparison to, say, a woodland. If you go into a woodland, the difference is, I mean, I'm sat now in my own living room now. I've got a carpet, I've got a chair, I can see everything around me. I know it's clean. You know, we've dusted the spiders away. There might be the odd woodlouse hiding in a window frame somewhere. But apart from that, it's essentially a dead environment. Everything that's in here, I know about. But then, very much like Merlin taking Arthur into the woods and dumping him in the middle of the woods, it's the dragons, if you like, are almost tiny dragons. Because you go in, you sit yourself down in the leaves, and immediately you are covered in life. You know, there are worms, earwigs, beetles, centipedes, just all around you. You know, within a square meter, there could be a million creatures just where you sat. And then as you sort of take that in, and you think, okay, I am going to stay, even though these things are running all over me, I am going to stay and I'm going to see what happens, because none of these things essentially bite. It's not like being in a rainforest and we don't have wolves and bears and lions and all that sort of thing. You can sit there quite safely and just watch the creatures around you. And then you suddenly think, well, hang on a minute, these green plants are alive as well. So that means what I'm sat on is alive and what I'm sat in is alive, as well as the things that are living on and living in these things which are alive. And before you finished, you suddenly realise actually you are just a small pinprick of life in literally billions of life forms. If you could photograph a forest, for example, using Kirlian photography, so you're looking at energy, you're looking at life and electrical impulse, the whole thing would just be a crescendo of exploding light, because everything is alive. It's not like being in a house where every now and again you get the odd thing that's alive. The odd thing might have a battery or an electrical charge, or it might be a spider living up in the corner or a fly on your window. In a woods, it's you are literally sat completely surrounded. In some cases, if you get too close to an anthill or a beetle's nest or whatever, you're literally covered in life. It's all over the place. And that is the dragon that Merlin was trying to get Arthur to face. That was the light bulb I think he was trying to get switched on. And there's nothing in the woods at night that isn't there in the day. It's exactly the same. Yes, we get the odd thing like an owl or whatever that comes out, but I've seen owls flying in the day. They'd fly in the day if the woods didn't have people in them. So there's nothing there at night that isn't there in the day. The dark is just us facing our fears. It's almost like going through the wild hunt, going through the initiation of being dumped in a forest and just sent out there, and you have to face your own fears. And that's what you're doing. The fear factor, if you like, is coming from you. Because Merlin, obviously, because he's a woods man, he's the man of the woods, the wild man of the woods, he knows all this. He knows what he's going to meet in the woods. He knows what lives in the woods. He's connected with that life force. He accepts that life force. There's a wonderful bit in the Merlin TV series that was on where they're riding through the woods and there's this massive snail crossing the path. And they're on horses and they stop, and Merlin turns to the person that's with him and says, "No, hang on, we've got to stop because he has right of way." And you see this snail crawl across the path and while these guys are chatting, and then as the camera cuts back again, it's gone, it's passed, so they can ride on. And that just got it. That hit the nail on the head about the idea that we can live in our houses and occasionally invite nature in, or it'll come in as an intruder. But by heck, you want to try getting out there in the woods and turning the tables, and we go out to meet them, we go out to it, and we go out into the woods, and it is an experience, it is an initiation. Everybody should do it, you know, not sitting at home with the computers and all the rest of it, surfing the web. People need to actually get out there, like you say, into a woods where very few people go. Obviously, you wouldn't want to do it straight away without knowing that you could get back to civilization. But definitely go out there and face it. And honestly, when the light bulb switches on, the world suddenly becomes a safer place as well, because you've done it. You know a bit more about the life that you're a part of. You know, it's like that bulb coming on. So yeah, totally agree with you on those points.
And then, of course, we have Lord of the Rings, which is laden with symbolism. And we think of the sequences with the trees. I can't remember off the top of my head. That's right, of course.
Yeah, the Ents.
We have them, and the sort of like thinly veiled environmental message there, and the idea of the trees, of lungs of the planets. I remember that phrase when I was reading about the clearing of the Amazon back in the 80s. But the Tolkien thing's very powerful, and it's interesting what so many people, you know, the Ents in those stories that resonate strongly. You know, people, I remember going to the cinema and watching Peter Jackson's films when they were released, and people were kind of rooting for the trees, if you don't mind me.
Oh, yeah.
That metaphor.
Well, I mean, that was an interesting thing, because Tolkien was writing post-war and he'd seen huge amounts of destruction. I mean, it's come back to the fore again, because obviously it's the anniversary of the First World War and the Great War and, various battles and what have you. So there's tons of stuff on the television now all about war and battlefields. Battlefields were utterly, utterly devoid of anything. You know, they were scorched earth. And what Tolkien was trying to do was to say, well, hang on a minute, if we go out there and we fight each other, but we fight the planet as well, the planet ultimately is going to turn on us. It's going to come and fight us. And that's what the Ents are. And good old Tolkien, because, yeah, I was rooting for them, if you pardon the pun. I was, you know, yeah, definitely. So hopefully I've got that over in the book as well, because I do, I think, very, very briefly right at the end, mention popular culture, and that's one of the things that I put in.
Now, of course, the Industrial Age began well before Tolkien's day.
Oh, yeah.
You know, essentially, yeah. And the scientific era started before that. However, it seems that from the dawn of the industrial age onward that these ideas have increasingly been driven out. And increasingly over the centuries, we've lost a connection with nature. And I think we've really paid a price for that, and not just materially, but spiritually as well, and in ways that we can't really quite put our finger on. That, and we think in some ways, and we've touched upon this multiple times, you just did a moment ago, you know, the idea that we've somehow tamed the planet. But then you think about how absurd that is, and you look about in terms of ecological problems now, how the planet seems to be biting back. And it's almost like, you know, the way, I don't know, it's like an animal that's in a, you know, being prodded, and it kind of initially it might be a little bit irked and it might move out of the way, and you prod it again and you prod it a little bit harder, and at some point it just lashes out. And I think really that could be a sort of metaphor for where we find ourselves today in many ways.
The ancients actually were a bit more broad-minded even than that. They put it on a much bigger scale, and we've already touched on it actually in this conversation, because as I said earlier on, everything has a life cycle. I can't remember exactly what the time period is, but somewhere between 7,000 and 9,000 years, people like the Egyptians and the Greeks believed that the world went through this big circle and then cleansed itself of anything that it didn't want. That there was a sort of downward spiral, and then there was this massive catastrophe, and then everything built itself again. So I do wonder if the harder we push, the faster we accelerate some form of catastrophe. So it's almost inevitable, if you like, that all that's here now, everything that we have now, will come to an end at some point. You know, somebody's going to get left to turn the lights off when it all goes pop. And it's not if it all goes pop. It most certainly is when it all goes pop. And what we do, we either slow that process down or we accelerate that process. And it's only in recent times that people have really begun to understand that actually we are, as far as the planet Earth's concerned, we're just another animal. We're just another part of something that's much bigger. And we affect what we do in the same way that the rest of the planet affects what happens. And we need to appreciate that, and sort of the best way to take control of it is to work with it rather than against it. That's inevitable. But then it could be that, you know, the ancients were right, and somewhere between 7,000 and 9,000 years from some unknown starting point, it all just gets obliterated again and starts all over again from whatever it is that survives. Certainly you see that in the fossil record, and now we're looking at sort of prehistoric humans from a DNA perspective, you'll find quite a lot of that information floating around, and it's more and more looking like it's this process of extinction followed by expansion, and then extinction, and then expansion again, coupled with climate and geographical change. That seems to be the pattern.
Now, there's a lot of rising environmental awareness, consciousness today, at the same time as we're witnessing, you know, these increasing problems and environmental degradation and pollution and what have you. And it's like these simultaneous trends pulling against each other. And in all of that, there also almost does seem to be a certain strand that is in a rush to collapse in order to kind of get it out of the way, almost like you want to get out the other side of something that appears inevitable. You know, like it's if you've got to have three teeth removed, you know, why would you have it done one week and one the next week? You just say, okay, doc, just get it over with, you know.
Yeah, but most of the people that are in that particular camp, unfortunately, design nuclear power stations, and that's the thing that worries me.
Yes, exactly.
That's going to finish us off. That's the one that'll end us all.
I think it's interesting. I mean, what can we really say in the face of that, except we will have to, if we can, cross that bridge. If there's a bridge there when we get to that particular Rubicon, we'll just have to see what it holds for life on Earth. I've always said that I think the planet will be okay. You know, it's just a question of what life on the planet will be 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now. You know, who knows? But what do you make, just a brief little detour, because in terms of modern, how can I put it, you know, as what Terence McKenna mentioned, the archaic revival, and we're thinking about Wicca in, you know, 19th to 20th century, modern witchcraft, just thinking about in terms of traditions that are relevant perhaps to our story, but we have similar things happening around the world. There seems to be an understanding that there's something that, while we can't go back, as it were, you know, going back to nature. We are part of nature. We must always move forward, but it's like that there's a balance here. You know, we are living as part of a single system and it needs to be rebalanced in order that we can move forward. You know, it's not, the idea of progress isn't out the window, just not the sort of progress we're making. And I think the interest in traditions such as Wicca, whatever it happens to be, and 100 other things seems to be on the rise as a way of having that balance, but also a balance in our own psyches between the literal and the symbolic and the scientific and the, you know, an intuition and male and female and all these different, any of all sorts of other dualities you might care to mention. That just seems to be something that's arising in response to some of the crises that we've brought on.
I think it's almost like, how can I put it? Back to dragons again. If you were to view spirituality, if you view it as a dragon, I think science and the way man has tried to quantify and, you know, identify and label and all the whole, you know, computer world and all that sort of thing, they've tried to put this dragon in a box. And you can't do it. Man is an essentially spiritual creature. That's what we are, to one extent or another. Even somebody who says, I have no spirituality at all, will have some measure of spirituality. They're just in denial. It's unavoidable. That's who and what we are. And what's happened, I think, is in recent times, they've tried to put that dragon in a box. They've tried to put it in there, push it down and shut the lid. And the response to that, certainly in my lifetime, I mean, I was born in the 1960s, so I grew up in the 1970s, and I've watched this spiritual dragon, post-war dragon, break back out of the box again. You know, they've tried to sort it out, they've tried to make it scientific, they've tried to control it, but at the end of the day, spirituality will rise. It will inevitably be a part of the human experience on planet Earth. You can't escape it. Then you've got, like you say, you look on a wider scale and you look all the way around planet Earth, and it comes as no surprise then that every single human being pretty much on the planet has a path of some kind and a spiritual consciousness of some kind. So the dragon is well and truly out. It's starting to come out. And again, it's like everything else. If you're in denial and you go, no, it doesn't exist, man isn't a spiritual being at all, let's just forget all that, you know, let's all go psychological or biological or however you want to do it, cut the spiritual side out, you're bound to fail because that dragon will jump out of the box and it will bite you. And I can see that happening all around the world. You know, you've tried to go for the secular society, you've tried to go for, you know, unity amongst different countries, which is the big topic now with the EU and things like that. But at the end of the day, there will always be somebody who's willing to fight for what they believe. And that belief, very often, amounts to irrational spirituality. That's what it is. It's the dragon. It's coming out of the box again. It's escaping. So it's not something we can hide. Back to the Green Man book again. It's like that life force itself. It's the theme of the Green Man book. You can't stick it in a box and nail the lid down and wish it to go away. It isn't going to do that. So as much as the planet is this spirit thing, this spiritual creation that lives and has a life and an ecology of its own, a human being is almost an exact reflection of that. Back again to this idea of the life force of the planet and man trying to connect with it, the realization that we are just another part of this whole thing. If there's spirituality out there, then there's spirituality in here. And I just see this as this trying to nail the dragon in the box, and it's now gone the opposite way. There are lots of people out there now who are keen to find out what this human spirituality is and what we're capable of and where it's going to take us and move us forward. And it's on all levels. It's right across the board. Just as much as 1,000 years ago Christianity went off and had its crusades and went off and explored the world and conquered some people and changed economies and altered religions, and, you know, that was our blast, if you like. But it's coming back the other way now. You know, Islam's coming this way, and we've got people willing to fight for that. The whole idea, jihad is just their word for crusade. They didn't have such a word until we went out there in 1099 and decided we were going to take Jerusalem off them. All of a sudden we taught them what a crusade was, and now we've got this idea and it's coming back. but it's the dragon again. We've tried to nail it in a box and go, right, that's it now. It's not medieval anymore. We're all civilized. It's the 21st century. You know, let's move forward. But it's not the 21st century in North Africa, and it's not the 21st century in the Middle East. They're having their, you know, 1066 moment now. That's where they're at, because they're all at different stages of human development. So I don't think we'll ever get the dragon in the box, and I think it's actually a good thing overall that it comes out, that it's out of the box, that people do say, hang on a minute, we are spirit beings, we are spiritual. Let's all sit down and talk about this and do something about it. And that's something I think witchcraft in particular had something to contribute and show, because it was such a persecuted and stamped down and hidden, secret, undercover path for so long. And then all of a sudden, all the stupid witchcraft laws that had been on the statute books for hundreds of years, 1952, 53, they abolished them. They just got rid of them all. And it could come out. And it came out. And that was just such a fantastic thing to happen. It should be an example of how we deal with a lot of these other paths and these other situations that are around now. We ought to, you know, say, yeah, it's fine. Come out. Show yourselves. Let's get into a dialogue and talk about it. Which, unfortunately, I think a lot of people are not of that particular mindset nowadays. I think the word establishment is one day will become a dirty word, because there are too many people with too many interests who are clinging on to things and not allowing other people to just blossom and come out and be themselves. I mean, I'm a fantastic fan of equality in every way. I think people should just be who they are and be allowed to be diverse, which again goes back to what I said previously about cloning. You try and make everybody the same, you're bound to fail, because our survival, the human strategy, is one of diversity. The more diverse we are, the better we are, the bigger we are, the more creative we are. And we should be encouraging that diversity and bringing it through, which is, you know, that's something hopefully that the 21st century will embrace. I'd love to see that happen before my time on planet Earth comes to an end. But I'm not planning to leave soon.
Okay, well, you know, maybe, Mark, then you'll agree to come back in 1,000 years from now and we'll have a chat and see what things look like. In the meantime, today we've been talking about your latest book, Revealing the Green Man. That's widely available. Just as we wrap things up for today, mention your other books, website if you want to share one, and just anything else you want to put out there.
Okay, if people want to come and find me, they can do a Facebook search, because I tend to work mostly on Facebook, simply because it's immediate. I don't have a website as such. So if I like the look of you, I will friend you. There's no problem at all. Just make an approach, and you can see what I'm up to, because I post everything on there. Book-wise, there are 3 books out with John Hunt Publishing at the moment. There's The Disappearing Ninth Legion, which looks at the Roman legions that marched out of York and then vanished and disappeared. It looks at all the ghost stories and everything, the archaeology associated with them. There's The Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood. If you want to get that book, it's spelled Robynhoode. So if you want to do a search to find that book, don't just type Robin Hood in the normal way. But I'm sure you'll find it, Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood. That was out last year. It's doing very well. The new one is Revealing the Green Man, which is the one that's just come out now. That was available as of this month, July. It's now ready to purchase. So dash out there and order that. And I think I can probably exclusively reveal that the next one might just have something to do with King Arthur, because I've been working on a book about the real King Arthur for quite a long time. So hopefully I'll get that out some point next year. So that's it, really. You've got District 9th Legion, in Life and Times of the Real Robin Hood, and in Revealing the Green Man.
Splendid. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today on LegaliseFreedom.com.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegaliseFreedom.com. That's Legalise-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegaliseFreedom.com.
Thank you.